inter-kingdom unnatural participation in the fight.
It's not to be late. Glad you introduced me.
So hi, I reached that funny age where I never know which glasses to wear. So I'm going to have to wear the glasses that allow me to see the script, which means you're all a blur, which is a bit like cattle see people in fields. So that's the first thing. The second thing is I'm going to try and read this off an iPad. So forgive me. What you can't see is I've got a little television screen here that shows me the slides. But, we're running an episode of The Kardashians, which is good. Okay, so I've entitled this The One and the Many Inter-Kingdoms Unnatural Participants. And I just wanted to start really with this wonderful quote from Michel Serre, which is really him quoting Leibniz, a flight of screaming birds, a school of herring tearing through the water like a silken sheet. This is very Michel Serre-like writing. A cloud of chirping crickets, a booming whirlwind of mosquitoes, crowds, packs, hordes on the move and filling with their clamour and space. Leibniz calls them aggregates, these objects, sets, and he brought them to people's attention at least, even if he undervalued them merely by according them the status of a heap of stones, even if he kept them mum by classifying them under harmony. And really that's my starting off point, and as Erica said, this notion of the farm animal, the contrast between the individual and the aggregate, the one and the many, and how we think about that from social sciences, humanities, animal science, and so on. So just to start, and I'm afraid I'm going to read this, you know, you spend hours writing these things out, and then you think you've got to sort of give you a version that isn't read, and it's very difficult to do, so forgive me for reading it. So a colleague and I were recently standing on the narrow circular edge of a farmed salmon cage deep in a Scottish sea lock, which was a few months ago. We were, to borrow Laura and Lien's phrase, quote, standing on the rooftop of a city of fish. Inside the 15 metre deep container, largely invisible in the dark waters, were over 25,000 mature salmon, each between 4 and 5 kilos. They were impossible to see, let alone to count. The density of these fish in their three-dimensional space is calculated not in numbers but in biomass, reaching upwards of 25 kilos per meter cubed at harvest. This mass of fish, no longer a shoal or a school, is for us observers an essentially undifferentiated multitude, bred in tanks containing over 1 million fry, graded into cages of similar size for smolting and mature growth. The fish are fed, grown, and treated as one, a plural trope, if you like, of productive agriculture. At what point, if at all, do these individual fish break out of their collective noun to become at last singular? Well, the answer, most obviously, is at the moment of their slaughter, when, albeit briefly, their sentience and their ability to feel concerns us. But also, less obviously, at specific moments of handling, treatment, grading, or intervention, all of which are physical moments of human-fish interaction. At these occasions, the individual fish is acknowledged and accounted for. For a short time only, being a fish matters to us as a fish. Now, similar observations we might make in a broiler shed. These appear, and sort of this is before and after type photographs of a broiler shed, these appear spacious, almost luxurious at initial stocking, when 40,000 three-day-old chicks run over the littered floor. This is a welcome change for many from the tight conveyor belts, beak-clipping machinery, and ventilated transportation box of their first 74 hours. Within 30 days, however, and you'll see that on the second slide, the space is completely transformed. Each bird has roughly the space equivalent of a sheet of A4 paper, with recommended maximum pre-thinning density in the UK being around 22 birds per square metre. The chickens here are undifferentiated, multitudinous, excessive. But contra Spinoza, this is a multitude without any power. Like salmon, though, there are individuals that, because other things are mattering to them, are not conforming to behavioural norms or growth standards. They become visible and identifiable. And of course, this is often their undoing. Their moment of singularity is very often the moment of their culling. So the singular farm, if you like, is increasingly a place of ever greater multitudes, a deceptive and porous aggregate, to use that word again, that is in so many ways, very much less than the sum of its constituent parts. What might stand as a seemingly fixed entity or unit, the farm, is in reality a constant flow and passage of multiple life and individual lives. So to borrow from that lovely aphorism attributed to Heraclitus, you can never really go into the same river twice. I'd say you can never really go into the same farm twice. The life and lives within a farm is forever changing and moving. Yet, as Erica said in the introduction, farms are arguably the most defining sites of contemporary human-animal relations, ordered yet dynamic umwelts of species mixing and co-mingling. The vast majority of the 24 or so billion terrestrial farm animals that are kept and grown for human and other consumption at any one time do so on farms, with an increasing proportion of them on large-scale industrial farm units. This is where kingdoms most emphatically meet and collide and intertwine and entangle, the sovereign and the beast and the sovereign. And yet in these numbers there's also an invisibility, a de-singularization, as Boltanski and Thévenot have called it, or a de-animalization, as Catherine Remy has called it. In today's large modern livestock farms, the individual animal is subsumed into a functional collective of normative material life. But of course, there is no herd without the individual animals that compose it. Just there is no herd without unity. Again, Michel Serre claims, we are as little sure of the one as we are of the multitude. If, as Levi-Strauss famously said, animals are good for thinking with, then with respect to farm animals, we might quote Vinciane Desprez, who argues numbers merely help us to stop thinking. Now, I like to think about farms. I spend most of my life at the moment thinking about farms, visiting all sorts of farms. So I recently visited deer farms, salmon farms, trout farms, chicken farms, sheep farms, pig farms, dairy farms, and so on. I seem to spend a lot more time hanging out in abattoirs at the moment, but that's for another day. I think many of us were introduced to that sort of rural agrarian imagery of the farm. It's a very popular set of images. Farms are still remarkably prevalent as children's toys, as anyone who's been looking at Christmas presents will have noticed. Infantile imaginaries, James Joyce's Moo Cow coming down the road at the beginning of that lovely book, was a benevolent, if supernatural, creature in Irish mythology. Accepting that there's a lot of vested interest in maintaining that alluring fiction of the farm, these are prevalent, nevertheless, and durable images. There's something of the knower about them, I think. These wonderful monogamous animalian couples that you can see here, these anthropomorphized humanimals. This is all about life and nurture and care and conviviality. And of course, farms are also all about life, not death. They don't kill the animals on the farm, they move them away. Although I found out yesterday at a meeting that nearly a quarter of a million dairy and beef cows actually die every year inadvertently on farms, which is a surprising figure. I'm staggered by that number. These are wasted lives, wasted deaths. They don't even get to the food chain. So I'm interested really in these animal lives, how these lives matter. And I'm intrigued in particular by this tension between individuality and massivity, or multitudicity, if you like, by the unity of the herd and the singularity of the individual, by the way that these affect or even condition our responsibility and our ability to respond with respect to farm animals. Now, animal farms, I like to think of animal farms as kind of like the capital cities of utilitarianism. This is, animal farms are where, perhaps it embellishes it most, this idea of the sort of classic utilitarian idea that what is considered to be good is taken to equate with the positive consequences that benefit either the animalian mass in its wholeness or the socio-technical production system in which these animals find themselves, or which benefit absent human sovereignty. For Jeremy Bentham, and for the UK's Farm Animal Welfare Committee, and for Peter Singer, utilitarianism provides really the basic moral backdrop for our treatment of farm animals. Yet, of course, utilitarianism is a philosophy of the mass. It's a philosophy of the undifferentiated, and in many ways the ideal philosophical position for modern animal farming, with its emphasis on the greatest number. To see things as numbers requires detachment, like salmon in tanks or poultry in a poultry barn. As the art critic Giles Fraser recently said, utilitarianism always sees from a distance. It has no understanding of particularity and individuality. Taking this critique of utilitarianism in relation to farm animals a step further, we might, like Derrida, no, I can tick that one off, I've done it. We might, like Derrida, object also to utilitarianism's abject empiricism. Animal suffering, when one sees it happening, when one confronts it on a farm or elsewhere, is not something you can simply calculate away on the basis of utilitarian consequentialism. On the contrary, it appeals to our compassion towards that non-human other, and particularly the vulnerable other in the farm. So, you know, to the tension, if you like, between the mass and the individual, we might map on also that between the calculation and the gaze, between the rational numbers and the affective and affected imagination. So how and when does the particular then count in animal farming? What counts as a life? What counts as an individual? How do we see and account for, and how do we not see and not account for, individual lives in that living mass of salmon or broilers or pigs? If indeed we should, you know, isn't that desingularization to some extent a necessary conceit? But I think at the end of the day, when you do stand on the edge of a farmed salmon cage, and I do, and hang on for dear life, because if you go that way, you're in with 25,000 salmon. If you're in that way, you're in the middle of the lock. It's quite a scary thing to stand on these things. When you're standing on the edge of these things, when you're standing on the edge of a broiler shed, what you actually see is, of course, the individual animals, and more particularly the eyes, or that sort of cognitive control centre, which we might call the face, if we accept that little anthropomorphisation. The face, which, as we all know, Levinas, tick him off, famously identifies as a locus of all moral responsibility. Yes, of course, Levinas pointedly distinguished the human from other animals as actually having a face, but Barbara Jane Davey, in a lovely paper that was published in 2007, argues that anyone who actually encounters a cow or a dog or even a snake in the wild is easily persuaded that they have a face too, and that from that face, communication and perhaps some degree of understanding and ethical commitment can flow. How can we look and not feel? How can we look and not know? So that's kind of like the introduction. The sort of two bits of what I want to talk about. First, I want to look very, very briefly, really, to set the scene, and I apologise, this might be sort of known knowledge. Set the scene by looking at two brief moments in the history of the farm and livestock farming that have acted, in my mind, ontologically and paradigmatically as critical moments of the denial of the animal as an individual. This is sort of sound a bit biblical, the denial, not the river in Egypt. That sort of thing. And secondly, I want to look more recently at contemporary attitudes towards the individual and the mass within farming, and look at some of the ways in which we account for the individual or don't account for the individual in contemporary animal science or welfare science or welfare ethics. So that's kind of the structure of what's going to follow. Now, commentators on the human-animal difference, and there are many, and we know many of them, often refer, and it was referred to at the Cosmopolitan Animals Conference a couple of weeks ago, to those famous three blows of human narcissism identified by Freud, although he would have happily added his own fourth one, and enshrined by Copernicus, Galileo, and Darwin. In parallel to those sort of three blows to human narcissism, we might equally speak of two foundational blows to the non-human animal, and particularly to those non-human animals we have come to call farm animals. And the first of these was domestication, obviously, which started, as far as we can tell, and I'm sure there are people better qualified to say so here, around 10 to 15,000 years ago. And secondly, the second sort of period, the second moment, if you like, that I wanted to quickly identify was what we might call machinization of animals. Which includes the industrialization and scientization of animal husbandry, which took place, you know, depending on what you read, about 9,800 or 14,800 years later. just very briefly, just to look at these two before going on to the sort of main substance of this. The domestication of animals as what we might call the first denial of the animal subject. The domestication of farm animals for human consumption, that Copernican moment, if you like, of human-animal relations, and as such, arguably, the most critical stage in the emerging anthropocentrist distinctiveness of the human, reflects the fundamental separation of the sublime individual selfhood of humanatus from the collective baser plurality of animalatus. And it is through this rendering plural of non-human beasts that humankind has taken its dominant place in the driving seat of the anthropological machine and has done so ever since. As humans, if you like, became individuals with the emergence of human civilization and culture, so animals were de-individualized through domestication. It's a lovely, I have a quote here that I haven't quoted from Derrida again, which is one you know, but he refers very well to this space of domestication as a moment, if you like, of the de-individualization of the animal in front of the human as distinct ontologically and in all other areas. For Cora Diamond and others, one of the criteria for a successful species domestication is that its individual members, rather than flee or attack when threatened with danger, seek protection through massing in densely packed yet socially ordered herds. Not only does such behaviour facilitate the physical processes of confinement and later domestication, but it also eases the shift from an empathetic and affective relation with individual animals to a more utility-driven rationale for generic explanation. And as James Serple has written, this is another one. I'm getting my slides muddled up. I don't have the Serple one, so I'll skip that. Well, let me read it out to you, sorry. As James Serple has said, referring to the domestication animals, non-human animal domestication is surely the most profound transformation that has occurred in human-animal relationships, setting the stage for later transformations that include factory farming, genetic engineering, and transplants of animal parts into human bodies. As cows became cattle, I'd like to say as sheep became sheep, it doesn't really work so well. As cows became cattle, and the growing attention paid to groups or herds of physically and behaviorally similar domesticated non-humans, this in turn paved the way for an altogether different approach to animal essentialism. Essentialism in the form of typologies and taxonomies. Most notably here has been, of course, the classifications from Aristotle onwards of similar animal entities or species. All the animals so classified within one particular group uniquely share conspecific properties, and the possession of such properties is held to have an explanatory significance as to why these animals do what they do. Hence, in a rather circular sense, a pig will do pig things because it's a pig. An animal will exhibit the character of its kind. And here's this lovely quote from Aristotle. The sheep is said to be naturally dull and stupid. Of all quadrupeds, it is the most foolish. It will saunter away to lonely places with no object in view. Oftentimes in stormy weather, it will stray from shelter. If it be overtaken by a snowstorm, it will stand still unless the shepherd sets it in motion. It will stay behind and perish unless the shepherd brings up the rams. It will then follow home. So as the sophistication of animal taxonomies grew, aided by observation and later by natural history, so did the relative importance of normality or conformity as a yardstick for inferring individual behaviour and form. A cow becomes to embody and represent and behave as the entire cow species. The French philosopher and historian Elisabeth de Fontenay puts it wonderfully when she described farm animals as the orphans of ethology, denied both the chance to express particular individual behaviour and ignored by ethologists and animal behaviourists in that hierarchical scandal that so favours the higher mammals and the great apes. So the domestication of farm animals coupled with taxonomic and biological classifications initiated and constitutes this first denial of individuality. Domesticated farm species are herd animals, vegetarian, grazing animals, who in the history of farming have lent themselves to this disappearing act of the animal's self. Of course, we all know the quote. John Berger has said it beautifully with his "Everywhere animals disappear." And although at that point in the book he was talking more specifically about zoo animals, whose disappearance sort of coincides with the increasingly artificialized visibility of television and the media, the farm species is surely just as potent an example of the disappearing individual. Such animals, writes Berger, have been emptied of experience and secrets. They have become de-singularized and therefore animalized. This is the real swinish multitude. So that's that first moment that I just wanted to identify. The second one I want to talk about is mechanization or mechanomorphization or industrialization. That's the second sort of key moment, if you like, in the denial of the farm animal individual. And of course, again, these are things that I'm sure you're all very aware of. This we kind of associate very clearly with the writings of people like Descartes, most notably. But arguably, it's a rationale and it's a position that takes us right up to the present day, as Erica has already mentioned in her introduction. The machinistic, if you like, I don't know if that word exists, the machinistic reduction of the farm animal to component within a productive unit, to meat on legs, to egg layer, to walking bacon, if you like. This is a disappearance of another kind. And I think there are two elements of this, the one ontological, if you like, and the other methodological. Now clearly, you know, Descartes has got an awful lot to answer for here. By reducing animals to the workings of clocks, as he did, Cartesianism not only heralded this machinistic notion of the animal, thereby distinct from the thinking human mind, but in doing so, of course, exorcised them from our moral consideration. Rather than being solely metaphysical, though, this position is fundamentally practical as well, for it provides justification for their treatment as machines. And of course, machines, we might argue, are by definition reproducible as identical units. So it's in this treatment that we find the second practical element in the industrialization of animal husbandry that has followed basically ever since. I don't want to go into this particular history of the industrialization of animals and animal husbandry progress. We will probably have other papers on this, and it's a story that Erica has already alluded to. But I think four words sum it up very well, these four words that surround this poor pig. confinement, concentration, intensification, and manipulation. Confinement, the artificialization of the environment of husbandry from outdoors to indoors, you know, the great movement of animals out of light, out of space, out of natural environment, into concrete, from glass to concrete to wooden slats, from natural light to artificial light, from the rhythms of nature to the rhythms of productivity, from freedom of movement to stalls, crates and crushes, and so on. The second is concentration. And by concentration, I mean the huge increase in animal numbers, from interspecies interaction to monospecies exclusivity, to same-sex groupings of animals, to smaller and smaller holdings as grazing is reduced, from the separation of breeding units and breeding locations from growing units, and so on. The third of these is intensification, the use of artificial feed. All cows eat grass, we learn when we're learning our base clef. Oh no, they don't. Very few cows eat grass, and they only eat grass at certain periods of the year. Intensification is artificial feed. We don't feed ruminants with grass anymore. With growth stimulants, it's preventative disease control, it's increased growing times, it's shorter lives, it's selectivity, it's artificial insemination, and so on. And finally, the fourth element in this mechanization is manipulation, from body manipulations to genetic manipulations. Whole new species exist, particularly within the poultry industry, particularly within the broiler industry. Very few, if any, of the major poultry breeds are original natural species. They've all been genetically engineered. Why? To fit in with the productive process. And just as we may increase their sensitivity, their ability to put on white meat in a productive boiler shed, we may find that they suffer from disease too quickly, so we'll get rid of that particular breed of which we've constituted many millions of examples, and we'll develop another genetic breed. This is the kind of way in which manipulation is going. So if Cartesianism paved the way for this radical mechanical model of the non-human animal, what has happened since in animal farming has been the gradual introduction of an equally radical thermodynamic model, or cybernetic model, or genetic model, where energy balances and feed ratios set growth targets and body conformities, where animal corporealities and materialities become components in wider self-regulating pharma-zootechnical assemblies, where species futures are preconceived through genetic manipulations that deny any evolutionary change in favor of normative and heteronormous change. Under a process of mechanomorphization, the animal is reaffirmed as a zootechnical machine, both physiologically and behaviorally, where science replaces care. Orphans, if you like, not only of ethology, but now of history, perhaps also of sociology, anthropology, and geography too. Haraway puts it nicely, as she often does, talking of the modern Chicken Little. She writes, "Our opportunistic bird is not against surrendering a pound of flesh in exchange for pecking rights and the natural, cultural, contractual arrangements that domesticated both bipedal hominids and winged gallinaceous avians, but there is something seriously foul in current versions of multi-species global contract theory." Yet above all, it's the sheer numbers that confound us, certainly that confound me. It's the sheer numbers, that plurality, as Derrida would have it, which not only masks the singular and individual, but also makes animal lives so very, very different. Abundance has its own ethical implications. Again, the ethicist James Searle has written it very well. Treating animals as groups of organisms, populations, species, ecosystems, and so on, creates ethical problems when it encourages people to ignore or devalue the well-being of individual animals comprising those groups. An extreme example is provided by modern intensive farming. So it's the nature of the systems of husbandry that create their own ethical positioning. And these are not absolutes, these are contingents. You do to a pig in an intensive farm what you would never do to a pig if you had two of them in your backyard. And although there's often contained within such sentiments a sort of bucolic nostalgia for traditional farms with smaller numbers of animals per farm and less intensive husbandry practices, where individual animals were recognized as such by the humans that cared for them, we need to be wary, though, of automatically assuming that such animals fared any better or worse. Nevertheless, numbers matter. The more of many, the less of one. So coming back to the contemporary farm, the question that really intrigues me is where is the individual living animal? And I think there are three issues here. How do we develop a set of ethical practices based upon the multitude of lives that occupy the modern farm? How do we nonetheless continue to see, differentiate, and account for the individual in this multitude? And how do we balance the two? It's not just about ethics, you know, it's too often about ethics. What it should be about is about seeing and being with and accounting for. Acknowledging animal lives, which is the problematic preoccupation not only of statutory animal welfare, but also of the care relationships that develop between animal and farmer and stock person, is a complex balancing act of the singular and the plural, the individual and the multitude, that is never adequately resolved. Now, my argument, what I've wanted to develop in the bit that remains, really, is that we've seen over the last 30 or so years a series of almost contradictory strategies for accounting for the individual farm animal within the multitude. And that contemporary animal studies of the sort we do here has an awful lot to contribute to this debate, but hasn't really done so yet. So let's look first at the role of the mass and the multitude. How do we account for that ethically? How do we account for that, pure and simple? As industrialized animal husbandry grew, so too, of course, did concern, both popular, scientific, and political, concern for the health and the welfare of the animals contained within such systems. Ah, let's be honest, this was driven predominantly by a concern for the productive and the reproductive health of intensively confined animals. To which it must be said, of course, there has also been a growing addition of societal moral engagement. I don't want to really go into that history now, others are going to evoke it later on. The point I want to make really is that the mechanisms by which the quality of life, the health and the welfare of individual farm animals in intensive systems has developed as an accompaniment, if you like, a necessary accompaniment to intensification, have been primarily, and to some extent entirely understandably, directed at the animal multitude, the group, the hypothetical standard, rather than the animal as individual. In essence, if you like, to the zoos and not to the bios. The individual animal becomes a statistical entry point in what is a summative concern for flock, for herd, for housing unit welfare. Moreover, these are artificially reconstituted groups. As you know, most modern herds and flocks are grouped by gender, by age group, by position within a reproductive cycle, not by any sense of inherent social organization or species integrity. Ethology, if you like, on a modern farm only goes so far. Thus, within successful animal husbandry, animal lives become identified and defined by mortality rates, by pregnancy failure statistics, by disease prevalence, by lameness, by tail biting statistics or feather pecking statistics, by growth rates, by longevity, by reproductive success, by yields, by body conformity, by carcass weights, to name a few of the standard indicators of herd health and welfare. Cows and sheep are identified by machine read tags and barcodes, some examples here on the slides. A spike on a daily chart of somatic cell counts in milk yield will identify a cow as ill. What we have here then is a combination of behavioural and somatic norms of what we might call standard functioning of the animal as a productive unit within the often stressful conditions and biophysical parameters of the farm environment. Consequently, intervention becomes generic through preventative herd health planning rather than targeted curative treatment. Individual animals that do not do well, that do not conform to growth curves and body mass indicators, are frequently culled as being, in simple terms, a waste of food or a waste of medical expenses, where the cost of treatment greatly outweigh the price obtained for the animal or its products. Play, too much movement, or excessive behaviour are all seen as wasteful energy expenditure. In short, the individual animal disappears into a generic standard functioning ideal type. Thresholds as well as behavioural norms are set by food chain operators and companies. 9% lameness in sheep is an acceptable standard before veterinary intervention is required. 35% lameness in dairy cattle, the UK average. 12% mortality rates in salmon farms are well within the norms. 3-5% mortality in breeding pig farms. In general, the higher the number of animals concerned, the higher the threshold levels beyond which something needs to be addressed. On intensive poultry farms, dead broilers are removed from the broiler shed daily, easily exposed. When you walk through and the live birds move aside, you see the dead ones lying there. In salmon farms, the dead fish, unseen, sink to the bottom of the tanks, sometimes in piles up to 5 deep, to be scooped up again, usually daily, with large nets. Increasingly, surveillance techniques are employed to identify the non-conformists. The latest, interestingly, being optical flow patterns that have been developed by Marion Dawkins, which picks up skews in broiler flock movement as a means of identifying ill animals, or animals suffering, birds suffering from ailments such as hawkburn, and therefore identifiable and then culable. And as herd and flock sizes grow, and that's the trend everywhere, the danger is, of Temple Grandin's words, that bad becomes normal. What is an acceptable level of lameness in dairy cows? And acceptable to whom? To the farmer, to the consumer, to the lame cow herself? Numbers, I come back to that statement by Vincian Desprez, help us to stop thinking. And of course, numbers help us to turn animals into objects that we can kill. We don't kill animals because we treat them as objects, we treat them as objects so that we can kill them. not a biopolitics so much as a sort of thanatopolitics. The increasingly automated surveillance techniques, whether they be cell count data obtained through automated milking machines, machine-read ear tags, video triggers of deviant flock movement, all this is crucial to the sort of thingification of the farm animal. Drawing on that wonderful book by Nicole Shukin, Animal Capital, which came out in 2009, we might argue here that the discourses, technologies, and practices of modern intensive livestock farming or the industry hinge upon a what she calls breaking and a denial of becomings. Where farm animals are, as Shukin after Derrida, Derrida, God, that's terrible. Never write things out phonetically. As Shukin after Derrida has kept it, I'll say that sentence again. Modern livestock animals are, as Shukin after Derrida has said, kept in a limbo economy of interminable survival, where coping is all, where needs are met but wants are ignored. The trouble with being one of the undead, says one of the more articulate vampires in the Twilight movie series, is that you can never move forward. You can never respond. I love that. I think that's brilliant. Let me go on about the Twilight series. Let me move on to sentience and the singular animal then. If this is the sort of idea about standard functioning, how do we account for the welfare of the singular animal? Everything I've said, you know, reprises a bit what Erica was saying at the beginning. All this, of course, is very mechanistic. It's very objective. It's very scientized. And ironically, of course, it still depends very much on the individual animal revealing itself to be in some ways unconforming to the standard functioning of its peers. The dairy cow that stands alone in the corner of the field, the trout that swims away from the feeding point, the de-feathered chicken that doesn't even stand up at all. These moments of individuality, however, merely define the animals as in some way wrong, as out of place, as not fit for purpose. Now, I think recent years have seen a certain recrudescence, which is not a word I use often, of the individual farm animals, a sort of re-presencing and purposeful acknowledgement of the animal individual. And of course, there's a number of reasons for this. Growing societal ethical concern for animal welfare is certainly an issue. Though, of course, you know, this has a very limited purchase, one might argue, and it is riddled with all the classic paradoxes and inconsistencies that so define human-animal relations in general. But it's certainly one influence. Another is the new popular anthropomorphization of the food animal. One thinks of that ghastly film Babe, about which Sue McHugh's written so beautifully in her latest book, but also the cows on those daft milk adverts you see on the telly. That's a second influence. A third influence might be the rise of what John Dupré calls the consciousness industry, the obsession with consciousness and sentience. And the fourth might be the emergence of a new, what we might call, ethology-driven welfare science. These are disparate drivers, I think, for this new individualization, but they have two things in common. First, they have in common a greater or lesser re-centering on the individual animal, its behavior, its sentience, its happiness, its anthropomorphized humanity. And second, I think these things have in common a persistent hierarchicalization and ordering of life. Hence, within the field of animal health and welfare, there's been in recent years an attempt to get beyond this sort of classic mechanistic Cartesian view of the animal machine, one that gives, at first view at least, greater place to the animal individual. The initially reluctant, we have to admit, acknowledgement of farm animal sentience within the veterinary profession and animal scientists is now recognised within the EU under the Lisbon Treaty of 2007. And this has certainly shifted attention from the functional performance of the herd, the flock, or whatever, and the broader conditions of their husbandry, to the subjective, feeling, embodied animal self. And we identify a whole school, if you like, in animal welfare science, what we might call the animal or the feelings-based approach to the welfare and life quality of farm animals. And this has certainly been very important in legitimating a new ethology, if you like, of farm animal science, albeit an ethology of control and domination, but nevertheless one that recognises the animal individual. And it's has significantly influenced, I think, the way in which welfare certainly is identified and assessed. And, you know, we might pull out three or four elements of this new individualization, or at least accounting for the individual within contemporary welfare science, the move towards from herd prevention, although obviously that still goes on, to more focus in certain contexts on individual treatment. From environmental and input assessments of welfare conditions, you know, how many feeders there are, how many bits of water, how many square meters an animal has to move around in, to outcome assessments and positive welfare benefits, how does the animal actually behave in response to these changes in the environment. From biometric to behavioural preference scoring, seeing what animals might choose to do when given a choice of two particular management options. From coping with the difficulties of being confined in a concrete pen to expressing some form of natural behaviour, or Bernie Rowlands called it their telos, their sort of animality, if you like. And finally, from a sort of zootechnical notion of the animal individuals to a more anthropozoic notion, where of course elements of anthropomorphism come in, and I'll talk about that in a moment to finish. So we have a whole series of novel techniques in animal welfare science, such as avoidance testing, when we see what sort of things an animal avoids and therefore spends energy that it might otherwise want for something else to avoid something. Is that a sense of an animal's choice? Preference testing, how an animal might prefer one situation to another. Qualitative behaviour assessment, these are all sort of tools that have emerged over the last 10 years to somehow bring that individual animal's sentience and feelings into account when we're talking about animal health and welfare. The notions of feelings that matter, individual farm animals, and our attempts to understand what these might be. And I think it's fair to say, and maybe others will challenge this, but I think it's fair to say that this is to some extent partly revolutionised animal welfare practice over the last 20 years in contemporary agriculture. It certainly informed the UK Farm Animal Welfare Committee's definition of a good life, which is their sort of latest policy thing, as one that combines an individual animal's needs and wants. While elsewhere, these often highly individualised notions of farm animal welfare have become almost commonplace in various assurance schemes and advertising strategies that food companies and retailers are increasingly adopting to promote particular ranges of food. Having a happy life is now supposed to matter as an element in consumer choice, as anyone who regularly reads the Waitrose magazine, which I regularly read, will know. What is special about Waitrose pork? Well, these are happy pigs. Now, while I think this rediscovered animal individuality and identity has certainly had a positive impact on raising awareness of the individual lives of farm animals and the quality of those lives, and in this it certainly led to a number of, I would say, significant gains in animal welfare, you know, the banning of battery egg systems, the move towards the banning of sow stalls, the move towards the banning of tail docking, piglet castration without anaesthetic and the like. You know, this is emerging from this sort of school of more ethologically informed welfare science. And it does nevertheless raise two key issues, and that's really what I want to think on to end, is the issues that are raised by this new individuality. And I have two concerns that I want to talk about. My first concern is this notion of an excessive anthropomorphization. Can we individualize the non-human animal without some degree of anthropomorphization, even within the scientific parameters of ethology? And the second question I ask is not this new attention to the individual animal to some extent flying in the face of a new, not so new now, but a new and less centered understanding of the thing or the self in relation, and in relation to the highly varied practices that constitute relations in the doing? And what I want to do to finish really is just explore these two concerns I have with the way in which we're re-individualizing the animal. And the first of these concerns, I don't know what the next slide is, can I quickly, oh no, okay, we'll stay there. Anthropomorphization. Anthropomorphization has always been the French have this lovely expression, the bête noire, the black beast of animal science, the demon of animal science. Anthropomorphization has always been this sort of black beast of animal science. Yet contemporary applied ethology, a growing awareness of animal sentience, the vocabulary of animal feelings and emotions that the happy chickens that Mara's published about. All of this has given a certain degree of anthropomorphization a new legitimacy in farm animal concern. And I think there are two dangers here. The first danger is the danger, as Marion Dawkins has highlighted in her latest book, is the danger of poor science. We're not always very good at identifying animal feelings and emotions. We have to approach the understanding of animal feelings and emotions kind of tangentially. We can't ask them. We have to devise all sorts of clever techniques for trying to identify what is an animal preference or an animal feeling or animal happiness, particularly within farm animals. And then it's very easy to be taken to task. You try telling a whole bunch of farmers to do a certain type of practice because otherwise the animals will feel unhappy. It doesn't go down very well. It's very difficult to convince because we don't have the science really to back it up. And linked to that is this sense that, do these feelings actually matter to the animal? How sure are we that the feelings that we're sort of putting up now as being important in animal welfare matter to the animal? One of the examples I often use is one of what we call body scoring. We look at the different marks on an animal's body, particularly piglets, for example, as a way of understanding how they might be bullied or attacked or whatever within the pen. Is that a genuine concern for the animal, the condition of its body score? Are these things that matter, or are they not simply an anthropomorphization and a difficult science? But the other critique and worry I have about anthropomorphization, and of course it's been fantastically useful in creating that sort of empathetic motherlode of concern, but nevertheless, anthropomorphization, which is usually associated simply with the attribution of human feelings and sometimes human thoughts to animals, in reality it goes a lot further. As Eileen Crist has shown in that lovely book, Images of Animals, looking at the sort of history of ethology, from Darwin to Konrad Lorenz and others, people use anthropomorphization very differently. Not just bringing human emotions to individual animals, but also human orderings, human priorities to the entire animal world. Creating both artificial proximity and equally artificial distance. And I come back to Thelma Roswell's idea of the hierarchical scandal of ethology, the elite status given to the carnivore killer, the superiority of the great apes, the docility of the herbivore. Are we not simply anthropomorphizing some form of social order onto the animal world? And isn't this conditioning our responsiveness to the animal individual? Anthropomorphism is a very one-way street that leading inevitably to the primacy of human orderings of the world. And the reconstitution of the animal as a sort of partially human self is fraught with difficulty. The sociologist Della Bernardina says it very well. It's a rather long quote. I don't need you to read it all, really. But his point is simply that we can think about all these status, the status of the animal, the protagonist in the encounter, as he calls it, in these histories, the action of the everyday encounter. But what do we do after it? It's one thing to present an animal in the antiseptic framing of a zoological or ethnozoological description, but an altogether different thing to place it within a narrative framework as agent agnostic in struggle in ambiguity. And here, I think, lies the inherent tragedization of the farm animal enrolled in an ethological discourse of suffering and deficient or lesser humanity, either on the part of the animal themselves or those criminal humans who treat them thus. So that's my first concern. If you could talk about my second beauty concern, this is excessive individualization, really. I think there's this overemphasis, or the danger of an overemphasis on the animal individual. I think there's a real danger that our newly focused attention on individual animal feelings as well as sufferings is in danger of reclassifying and reordering animals into behavioral types and behavioral repertoires that similarly invoke standardized solutions and responses. Once classified, the danger here is that the animal disappears again into some sort of behavioral standard or trope. There's that lovely phrase again of Donna Haraway, individualism is a strategic defense problem, which kind of invites two meanings. One, that there's no essential stability in individuality, that it can change according to context, and that different individualities emerge in different contexts or orders or practices of doing and being. Or as John Law has said it with respect to his recent work on salmon, there is no salmon behind the various practices that do salmon. On the other hand, this individuation can be overly reductionist, much in the same way as the animal machine idea is reductionist. For it lacks consideration of the generative social and environmental context within which most farm animals live. And I think the best example of this is dairy stalls. Over the last 10 years, we've moved more and more to the setting up of individual stalls for dairy cattle in a barn. So each cow has its own stall, which it can come and go into as it wants. And usually the best ones have got sawdust on them, or they've got rubber matting, and the worst ones have got concrete. And these were originally introduced very much as a sort of animal welfare advantage. These cows were not being bullied, because dairy herds are notorious bully. the older cows who've had two or three calves bully the younger ones. So the idea was that you give a cow an individual space, it would be able to express its own individual behaviour. But of course what this means is there's absolutely no social contact between the individual cows. The cows can't touch each other, the cows can't smell each other. The cows are sort of moved into this overtly individualised context. And there's an increasing concern that this is not actually the best thing for the farm, for the animals themselves. Writing recently on the impact of behavioural ethology on farm animal welfare, Christine Nicol from the University of Bristol observes that farm animals have preferred companions. They have friends. They have complex social behaviour. They will seek to spend time in social interaction at the expense of rest time and feeding time. These are wants as opposed to needs, and they are increasingly being understood as socially contextualised rather than purely individual. Yet, they are still being increasingly denied within modern animal husbandry practice, but also, I think, escape scientific investigation and consideration. You know, as Desprez has said in a number of papers, in trying to understand what animals want, the real issue is knowing what questions to ask them. So have we come full circle? I approach the end. Has the new animal centering of contemporary ethology only brought us back again to a generic, but nevertheless rather different notion of the animal as through some sort of normative individuation? And so I just want to end with an idea to explore this notion of relational sociability. And then about 5 minutes, I'll be done. The growing obsession with feelings of the individual animal, which includes such anthropomorphized ideas of animal happiness, coupled with an ethological interest to nail down as some inherently behavioral good the natural state or the natural behavior of farm animals. Both of these are certainly raising questions about how we treat and live with farm animals. It's being increasingly used, as I said, to push forward a broader ethical agenda, underwritten by rules, by codes of practice, by operating procedures, by assurance, by the behaviour and attitudes of farmers. Yet it is missing something fundamental. It might sound obvious, but a farm is, as I said at the start, a more than animal place, a more than human place, a place of constantly shifting multi-species interactions, practices, relations and adaptations. Animals cope with this as individuals. They cope with this as bodies, but they also respond, act and enact as members of a shared community, linking self and other, the living and the material, the non-human and the human, in a process of active socialization and hybrid sociability. Now this, we can't simply interpret this as a defensive mechanism of self-individualization, although some may present it as such. But it might become, in the words of Tim Campbell, an opening towards the relational, a moving the self towards greater openness and relationality as opposed to merely a defensive position. And in these movements, we move away, according to Gail Davis in a recent quote, from the formal areas of bioethics and towards the ethical issues emerging in the work of Haraway and others as they seek to explore the political and ethical implications of grappling with rather than generalising from the ordinary. With regard to farm animals, it's been commonplace to define rather singular ethical categories and develop our rules and behaviour from them. The farm animal is one such category, though we treat, say, broiler chickens very differently from the way we treat beef cattle. In her account of Lovenheim's narrative as a farmer, Sovel, in a lovely article in the 2005 Society in Animals, explains Lovenheim's concern for the welfare of his cows as a product of his formal status as their owner. Yet this only goes so far. Grappling with the ordinary, to come back to Haraway, implies a different interactive ethical practice, one not founded on predefined categories such as ownership, which, as Stengers has pointed out with regard to the non-human, are fraught with all sorts of difficulties anyway. But an ethical basis built on practice, on co-participation and the mixed community, or as Turner has said, on the civility between humans and the animals in their care. Now this then is, I think, where animal studies needs to go, I think. And this implies new methodologies of engagement, drawing more on the social sciences and the humanities than on the animal sciences and ethology. But as Erica was saying earlier, farm animals just aren't sexy for animal studies. And it's a great shame. If a non-human animal's story is to be told or heard, this requires different types of listening than that to which humans are accustomed. And specifically, what I think animal studies, what the animal studies community, might bring to this research, analysis, and commentary is, you know, some of these ideas, really, this notion of a symmetrical agency that makes the human-animal culture of sociability and conviviality at the farm. And there are studies that are doing this, but they are not very many, and I think they're still very much in their infancy, and I wish we did a lot more of them. The second is the sort of co-construction of regulation and standards. It's amazing how, when you actually look, and as Emma Rowe has done, when we look at how standards are constructed on the farm and negotiated on the farm, the role of the farm animal in that construction process is often ignored. They're handed down, as it were, from some retailer or manufacturer standard scheme. Thirdly, the narratives and practices of farm animal human interactions. There's been a whole series of books published recently, you know, like The Philosopher and His Dog and all these things, and, you know, Paul Auster's book. And there's a whole lot of books about people and the narratives of living with pets, but very, very few books on the narratives of living as a farm animal, except for that terrible one, The Secret Life of Cows. And fourthly, what I'd like to see is more ethno-methodologies of observation, shared movement, shared play, and shared materiality. So I think implicit in all of this are two things. First, a recognition that is often intuitive rather than analytical, but hey, that's just as good. A recognition of the degrees of shared experience, movement, affect, materiality between the human and the non-human. And second, how the decentered relations that are thus established become constitutive of a more practical, convivial, and empathetic understanding. Now, such a convergence, what I'm really arguing for here, I suppose, is a convergence of ethnography and ethnology. A convergence of ethnography and ethology that some, there's a French guy who's tried to recast this as ethno-ethology. Or even a sort of tripartite ménage à trois, if you like, of ethology, ecology, and ethnology. Here, accepting the relational status of multi-species encounters, we imply a phenomena of culture that extends way beyond the purely human sense of the word. And this could be a really dynamic area, I think, for social sciences and the humanities to get into the sort of farm animal scene. And in a similar vein, the geographer Hayden Lorimer, from up here, he advocates in a book published a year ago what he calls a new calibration of ethology and phenomenology to better comprehend life's ongoing occurrence, which resonates with that Haraway phrase from a moment ago. Arguing that novel understanding of human and farm animal relations are revealed through ordinary circumstances, life outdoors, and the elemental phenomena of life, Lorimer advocates a slowing down of the world to quicken the senses. And it's for this very purpose, I'm going to end on him, that a friend of mine, a French ethnographer called Florent Collet, recently spent the whole of his summer sitting in a field with a herd of blonde d'Aquitaine cows. And he writes this up in a paper, just sitting there with them, observing them. And the resulting empathy, he believes, he developed for the cows should not constitute, he argues, an obstacle, but should constitute a precondition for the understanding of this human-animal culture. And there, a photograph of the two cows he spent 3 months living with. That's it. Thanks.